Updates tuned to yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. True history in this hour, as Biographies and Sound brings us a profile of the heralded writer H.L. Mencken and the history he made along the way in his journey through print journalism. A month before this broadcast, his voice was heard as narrator for the CBS Radio Workshop program Bring on the Angels, which was about journalism at the turn of the 20th century, broadcast posthumously just a few days after his death. This episode from a month later, on July 10, 1956, on NBC, called H.L. Mencken, The Bitter Byline.
During his career, H.L. Mencken was called a ghoul, maggot, toad, buzzard, swine, cockroach, hyena, jackal, cock crowing on a dung heap, a lecher, a prig, a Nazi, and a communist. This is by no means a complete list, but it gives you an idea of the wrath he inspired.
H.L. Mencken, The Bitter Byline. Another in the transcribed award-winning series of Biographies in Sound.
The volume of mail that comes in to a magazine or a newspaper or a radio station is no index of anything, except that you happen to attract a lot of idiots, because most people that write letters to newspapers are fools. The intelligent people seldom do it. They do it sometimes, but not often. I used to, in my days running a column, I welcomed the letters that came in and, in fact, edited them. I was in charge of the letter column and always let anybody that denounced me violently get in, because I believe that people like to read abuse. I didn't care what they said of me. I was much too vain to care what such idiots believed about me. In fact, I'd have been ashamed if they praised me, and so letters praising me very seldom got in that column.
I'm Chet Huntley. That voice you just heard is that of Henry Louis Mencken, born 1880, died 1956. The recording was made 8 years ago, when Mencken could look back on an active professional life of over half a century. 50 years in which he had muddied the mainstream of American thought and habit with a constant barrage of journalistic sticks and stones. Within the next few months, his fabulous brain would be struck and permanently damaged by a cerebral hemorrhage. But at this moment, Mencken was in his caustic prime.
Well, in politics, I'm a complete neutral. I think they're all scoundrels, without exception. There are, especially that is true, of the reformers. I've known politicians by the thousand all my life, and I'm here to tell you that the most pleasant men, and on the whole, the most honest of them, are what are ordinarily looked on as machine politicians.
He had equally definite views on marriage, war, sociology, medicine, music, and, of course, religion. These views were jammed into some 35 books written, compiled, edited, or co-edited by H.L. Mencken. They range from What You Ought to Know About Your Baby to The Philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. We've heard him. Now let's take a look at him.
Mencken had the brightest eyes, and when he would talk, they would twinkle.
Not too much neck. And the most impish nose that anybody had ever seen on a grown man.
Stucky, sloped shoulder, jet jaw. He always looked as though he'd just been scrubbed up with ivory soap. His hair was a kind of sandy red, which he always parted in the middle.
Where does Mencken get those clothes? Because when they happen to bend up or something, if they wrinkle, they look like tin.
It'll be a long time before the experts agree on Mencken's contribution to society, literature, or America. Sure, college students in the 20s swore by him, but many others swore at him. That was in the 20s and 30s. What about the 80s, the 90s, the 21st century? What will be left of this literary ball of fire, the man who liked to stir the animals around? Well, some think Mencken caused a literary revolution.
At the time that Mencken became a critic and an editor, before the First World War...
James Farrell, the author.
American fiction was largely dominated by second-rate writers, by writers who overemphasize the smiling aspects of life at the expense of truth and character, and this country was culturally provincial. There was an overemphasis on sweetness and light, on a false sweetness and light. Mencken had a very healthy taste for and respect for truth. Mencken also felt that the important subject of writing was the struggle of man against his own destiny. One of the most important achievements of Mencken as a critic was the fight, the struggle he carried on to gain acceptance for Theodore Dreiser. When Dreiser first began writing, there was a great furor. He was bitterly attacked. For years, Dreiser struggled in isolation. And it was Mencken who picked him up, who championed him, who fought for him, who attacked the critics, the professors, the prudes, the prissy-minded people. Mencken also championed other American writers, Sherwood Anderson, Edgar Lee Masters, Carl Sandburg, George Ade.
Ring Lardner. The list is a long one.
Eugene O'Neill, Scott Fitzgerald, Ruth Sukow are three writers who certainly were not established when they were published in the Smart Set.
Biographer William Manchester.
In the middle 1920s, Mencken became so interested in the developing scene in politics and social history that he lost almost all interest in literature. He literally stopped reading fiction. And his wife pressed Thomas Wolfe on him, and he tried to read Thomas Wolfe. He couldn't. He did read William Faulkner and saw nothing there. Certainly, he never wrote anything at all that I know of about Ernest Hemingway. So that the writers who appeared in the 1920s and 1930s not only had no help from Mencken, Mencken was almost universally wrong. But by that time, his interest had shifted.
Charles Angoff just wrote a book based on the 10 years he worked with Mencken on the American Mercury, H.L. Mencken, A Portrait from Memory.
I probably am in the minority, but I don't think he'll be remembered as a scholar. As a matter of fact, I don't think the American language is going to stand up as an enduring piece of scholarship. First and perhaps foremost of all, he was a great journalist, one of the greatest magazine editors America's had so far. The second area in which Mencken shone, and for which I think he will be remembered for a long time, was the general field of conversation. He was one of the most fascinating, most amusing conversationalists I have ever known, and I have a hunch that he was also one of the most fascinating and amusing conversationalists in all American history thus far. The third and final area in which I think he'll be remembered a long time is an area that probably would surprise him. Sheer patriotism. Here is a man who denounced American democracy, who denounced American history, who took apparently great pleasure in calling preachers and politicians and other eminent people all the printable and unprintable names in the American language. And yet this same man also loved this country as few other people have ever loved it. He was really a great patriot. And the fact is that in his day, when he was editor of the Mercury, he printed more Americana in the pages of the Mercury, I believe, than all the other quality magazines put together.
As for his stirring of the animals,
he was a great one for prodding people into thinking.
Lawrence Spivak of Meet the Press.
Into thinking about a subject, and frequently into acting about a subject.
Helped young authors. Conversationalist, editor, patriot, prodder, scholar. No, says Alastair Cook of the Manchester Guardian.
He will remain immortal, as far as he does so, by his use of the language and by his giving it not so much a generally American turn as by giving it a peculiarly Mencken-esque turn. For instance, he said, I think, that idealism is the theory that because a rose smells sweeter than an onion, it would make a more palatable soup. And another one I recall is that the Puritan is a man who fears that somewhere, somebody is having a good time. Those are very entertaining and recognizable, but it's possible to read them. And though you might think of Mencken, you could think of lots of other people. Mencken's great gift was his gift of simile and metaphor. And in it, you get the essence of the man, of his humor, of his determination to make a big noise, his determination to deflate windbags, and also you get a perfect, in miniature, his great craftsmanship. Now, a couple occur to me. He was very much against all forms of athletic sport. And he said that when he first saw a newspaper man wearing golfing pants, he said he looked like a stud horse with its hair done up in frizzes. And I remember finally his saying, his writing, I was sitting next to him when he wrote it, at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia in 1948. We were all beating out rather routine leads to our pieces, and suddenly there appeared on the platform a very comely lady. Now, she turned out to be Mrs. Dorothy Vredenburg, who was, I think, on the National Committee. And I saw Mencken's eyes begin to bulge, and he lifted his index finger. He typed only with his index fingers. And he started to beat out a sentence which said that this was the biggest shock in the recent history of conventions, he said, because here was a woman who was pretty and comely and good to look upon. He said, and this would cause a revolution in the politics of the Republic, in which, he said, heretofore, lady politicians have always looked like British tramp steamers dressed up for the King's birthday.
Academic? Well, there's one side of Mencken which you could hardly call penetrating. In fact, you can get some people to tell you that Mencken, at times, was just a clown. From Newsday cartoonist Edmund Duffy.
Henry loved America. He was not much of a traveler, really. I always remember Sarah telling him they took a trip a couple of years after they were married, and they went on the Columbus in a Mediterranean cruise. It seemed an odd place for Henry to be, you know, a cruise ship. Sarah told this wonderful story. Of course, the ship would stop at various places for a day or so along the Mediterranean. There was one excursion. Everybody went off to go to Carthage. And Sarah didn't go. She was kind of tired and decided to spend the day in her cabin. And late in the evening, she heard him coming down this long passageway of the ship. She could hear him, and he opened the door in the cabin. Sarah was lying there reading. And he said, "My God, Sarah, there's nothing left of Carthage."
Mencken the Joker, or Mencken the Shaker-Upper. It's a thin line. For example, there's Mencken's attitude toward preachers and politicians.
He looked upon preachers as congenital idiots and scoundrels, and the higher they were, the more he suspected them. Men like the late Cardinal Hayes and the late Bishop Manning particularly annoyed him. He thought both of them were, as he often said, frauds. And he thought that there were men of little intellectuality, of even less general decency. The general principle about preachers was that they were selling goods under false pretenses. They were giving comfort to people with regard to certain problems concerning which they knew just as little as the people they were trying to comfort. Politicians he also disliked and had contempt for. His basic principle, as he often told me, was that every politician is a thief until he proves himself otherwise.
On astronomy and vitamins.
When it came to certain scientific beliefs, he, for example, thought that astronomy was mainly hogwash. As he often said to me, it's just as unreliable as astrology and theology. And I said to him, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you read in books and magazines that Mars is so many trillion light years away." He says, "Well," I said, "that's just damnest nonsense ever heard of." He says, "I'm sure time will come when the same scientists, astronomers, We'll find out that Mars is only maybe 10 or 50 miles away, but the most maybe 50 miles away. He also used to laugh at vitamins and atoms. We were at the lunch table, and he says, "You see that glass of water?" I said, "Yes." He says, "You know, according to the scientific quacks, it has minerals in it. Show me a piece of iron." Well, naturally, I couldn't show him any iron. And he says, "See, no iron there." Then when the food came on, he says, "The medical quacks," he always referred to scientists, and nearly always, as quacks. Doctors were quacks, and physicists were quacks, and politicians were quacks. He says, "Look at this food here. They say it's full of vitamins. Show me a vitamin." I said, "I can't see it, but it's there." "There you are," he says. "Science has become loaded with theology. And the sooner we get rid of this nonsense, the more scientific science will become."
On the New Deal.
Of some of the men around Roosevelt, he wrote, "Hopkins, before his apotheosis, was a collector for the Red Cross, and after that a ballyhoo man for other such noisy organizations. How the Salvation Army missed him, I do not know. Ickes, he said, was a professional public nuisance in Chicago. And Madam Perkins, La Perkins, was a lady uplifter and a shining ornament of that appalling clan. He wrote at least one of them, it turned out some time ago, owes his degree to a college of chiropractic. And of Roosevelt himself, he wrote, if he becomes convinced tomorrow that coming out for cannibalism would get him the votes he so sorely needs, he would begin fattening a missionary in the White House backyard come Wednesday."
Was H.L. Mencken ever for something?
Mencken, in fact, was so violently anti-New Deal that he did something I don't believe he ever did before, and I'm not sure that he ever did after, and that was he came out in favor of a man for president. Mencken had always felt that his job was one of criticism, and he was always critical of almost every man who had been in the White House. Coolidge, Hoover, almost all of them. But in this case, I said he came out for a man. It was a rather mild endorsement of Landon, but nevertheless, it was quite a step for him to take. I believe he wrote, "It will be a good idea to try the Honorable Mr. Landon of Kansas. When he promises to do this or that, laying his hand on his heart and rolling his eyes toward the throne of God, there is at least a reasonable probability that he will make an honest effort to keep his word." He wrote, "If signs count for anything, the jig is now nearly up. My guess, strongly supported by a far from subconscious wish, is that the great masses of American freemen, including even multitudes now on the innumerable doles, will decide by November that some other scavenger, indeed any other scavenger, will be safer. There was a time when the Republicans were scouring the country for behemoth to pit against him. Now they begin to grasp the fact that if they can beat him at all, which seems most likely, they can beat him with a Chinaman or even a Republican."
Throughout the pages of the Baltimore Sun, the Smart Set, the American Language, Mencken ranted and raved. What he said sounded fantastic, and yet every once in a while after the first shock, his material provided food for second thoughts. The facts backfired.
I remember one time you sent in a piece.
Hamilton Owens, former editor-in-chief, the Sun Papers.
This was during the depths of Prohibition, which, of course, Mencken enjoyed tremendously. He wrote a piece and said that the political parsons had gone so far along this Prohibition line that he would prophesy that they would soon be using cola in place even of grape juice at the communion service. When I read that, I blanched a bit. It seemed to me an incredible exaggeration, however funny. So I called him up and I said, "Henry, I think we better cut that out." I said, "That's just going too far." He said, "All right, you're the jail editor. Cut it out." You know why he called me the jail editor? I was the responsible man, and if there had been a libel suit, I would have to be the one that went to jail. But about 3 days later, I had a letter from him in which was enclosed an advertisement in favor of some cola drink. And it was a letter, a reproduction, rather, of a letter on a church letterhead. What it said, in effect, was that we used your product at the communion service last Sunday, and all the members of the congregation commented on its delightful taste.
You ask yourself, can this man be kidding? Where does he stop, draw the line, and become serious? It's possible there is no line. Mencken may have meant everything he said and had a reason for saying it, his way. We asked Alastair Cook, how come Mencken never took his criticism a step further, from the destructive to constructive?
It's like asking a wrecking crew, how come you're not a bricklayer? And I think Mencken would have said that. I mean, he maintained that his function was to clear the ground, to fumigate the air of all the noxious odors. It was somebody else's job to grow the roses, you see. He was not in the rose-growing business himself. He was not good as a positive man in statesmanship or in inventing ideas or advancing plans. They were usually quite ludicrous and deliberately so when they were. But in his scholarship, you see, he was constructive. He loved putting things together like a puzzle. He was enormously thorough. Of course, he filed beautifully. He had a marvelous memory. And he was extraordinarily precise. And so, as you see, the whole layout of his American language, which never loses its humor, but it's the most beautiful assembly of vast materials from all over the world. And that's what he, I think, regarded as creative. But he just didn't have, he was honest enough to know, he just didn't have the creative flair. He was a critic of ideas and a destroyer of ideas. And when he died, Commonweal, the Catholic magazine, paid him an extraordinary tribute because they reproduced a paragraph they'd written 28 years ago when he wrote Treatise on the Gods and said that a man who fights for noble things and denounces the evils of his time, even when he doesn't seem to have anything to put in their place, is actually fighting on the side of the angels. He would probably have snorted at that.
There's plenty of rubble behind, evidence of Mencken's role as the one-man wrecking crew. But still, repertorially, we have only four W's and an H. Who, what, when, where, and how. There's a W missing. Why? Why this?
The idea of a newspaper reporter with any self-respect playing golf is to me almost inconceivable. I hear that even printers now play golf. That's dreadful to think of. I remember printers in my time. I knew a great many intimately. I always had to do with makeup on the papers, and hence I knew the printers. And I was very fond of them, and they were fine fellows. But golf playing would... It'd just seem as incredible as to hear of a printer going to a dance. Printers spent their leisure mainly in saloons. I learned a great deal more about the newspaper business from printers than I ever learned from editors. A great deal more. But now, when you hear of a printer going out and dressing himself up and playing golf, the thing is really obscene. It's dreadful to think of it.
From Alastair Cook, the answer.
Mencken was a very complex man. And I think, as a matter of fact, his extreme pleasantness in private life and his great gift of humor in his writing was actually a defense against all kinds of defeated idealism in himself. I think Mencken really was a disappointed idealist. And as so often happens, they turn into cynics. In other words, I think he expected too much of people. And therefore, when he doesn't get it, he makes them into clowns, you see. And I feel also that, of course, his bark was much worse than his bite, but I think he barked all that time because he was scared blue that he'd be taken in by the people he was actually trying to ridicule. Mencken came to a very good solution of his own inner complex. He was an immensely lonely man. He hated loneliness. He knew you could only work alone. He was disgusted by dishonesty and pomp. And though he tried to turn politicians into amusing people, he was actually a profoundly disappointed man, I think, in the standards that he saw people practicing around him.
The cynic is not popular. Entertaining, yes. But the cynic, like the truth teller, is a necessary evil at best. He looks down at everything and everybody, categorizes people his way, and won't take anything seriously. For 10 years, the relationship on the Mercury between Mencken and Charles Angoff was a fruitful one, until the Depression.
A year, 2, 3 years after Black Friday, 1929, he insisted that the Depression was a phony. A lot of people were out of work, he knew. The stock market was going to the dogs, people were jumping out of windows, and he said that's a very good thing to have a lot of people in trouble and bump themselves off and die off from starvation. It was good sociological therapeutics. In this way, we get rid of inferior people. His basic sociological doctrine is almost incredible in its naivete. He said it to me a great many times, and he also printed it. His basic sociological, anthropological doctrine is that the world is made up, in the main, of two classes, the congenitally inferior and the congenitally superior. By and large, according to him, the congenitally superior were the people who had money and a social position, and the congenitally inferior were the poor people who had no social position. And as far as he was concerned, it was the function of government to force the congenitally inferior to be the slave of the congenitally superior. Now, this was his political theory. Of course, I pointed out to him that a great many famous people sprang from the so-called congenitally inferior, but he would poo-poo me and he'd say, now, Engelhoff, don't give me that Harvard garbage. Well, he would say this to me, and I would laugh at him. Before the Depression, the disagreement would end with laughter. But after that, he'd get bitter, and I guess I'd get hot under the collar. So that after 1929, we had quite a number of battles. There was one issue of the Mercury in 1931, I believe, November 1931. We were making up the issue, and he said we should lead off with an article entitled "The Tragedy of the Sioux Indians" by Chief Standing Bull or Sitting Bull. At the moment, I don't remember, Sitting Bull or Standing Bull. And I blurted out, I said, "That's ghastly." I said, "People are starving. The world is going through some tremendous upheaval, and here we're leading off an intellectual cultured magazine with an article on the Sioux Indian by Chief Standing or Sitting Bull. We can't do that." And he shouted at me and he said, "So you've fallen for all that bilge about society going to the dogs." "It's not going to the dogs. As a matter of fact," he repeated, he says, "we are getting rid of a lot of worthless people. It's a wonderful thing. And this thing is going to blow over." This was November 1931. So I began to argue for my point, and he began to shout at me, and I guess both of us raised our voices. And finally, for the first time in our relationship, he said, "Well, I'm running this magazine. We lead off with this article." I think I knew at once that something had happened between us.
Engelhoff tried to understand Mencken and couldn't. Idealist Engelhoff, cynic Mencken, they don't mix. Somewhere between Mencken's happy childhood in Baltimore to his miserable death in Baltimore, he groped for his ideals and missed. When he stopped building icons and became iconoclast, we don't know. We do know that as a young reporter, Mencken was unmatched. Mencken moved from the Herald to the Sun. Those were wonderful days for Mencken. His words were increasingly bitter, his following growing. Journalism was different then.
Along about that time,
columnist Lou Azrael, at that time with the Opposition Post,
the political boss of Baltimore announced that he was going to retire from politics. And the editor of the Post decided that this was a good opportunity to have some fun. This editor, Harold Duane Jacobs, wrote several editorials presenting this viewpoint. Said, look, after all, it's the political boss who decides who's going to be mayor, who's going to be judge, who's going to be city comptroller, who's going to be everything around town. So he said, what we ought to do is to have an election to decide who's going to replace this political boss. And so he started to run coupons in the paper. It was all a joke, of course. Among the people who saw an opportunity for a great joke were the boys on the Evening Sun, for which Mencken did most of his writing. They thought it would be a lot of fun to have Mencken elected by the opposition paper as political boss. And so they started to collect these coupons and send them in, marked Mencken. Really caused a lot of trouble from a newspaper viewpoint, because all sorts of readers were calling up and saying, what about this? I got my paper and the coupon's been cut out. Well, the newsboys were selling these coupons for a couple cents apiece. Finally, the votes were tallied, and it was found that Mencken had been elected political boss through the election carried on by his opposition newspaper. I called Mencken. I said, "Mr. Mencken, you've been elected boss, and I think you ought to do something about it. You ought to assume your office." And Mencken laughed and said, "Sure, I'll go through with anything." So I went around town and found a brown derby. I had the staff artist paint "boss" across it in big white letters. I scoured the shops and found the biggest, fattest cigar I could find. We got in his backyard, and there, with great dignity and state, I presented him with this derby hat and the cigar as the insignia of office. Mencken cocked the derby over one side of his head, put the cigar into his mouth, and puffed at it like a boss while the photographer shot away. The photograph was published all over the world. A few weeks later, I got a letter from Mencken. He said, "Certain information has come to my attention which causes me to suspect that the ballots were stuffed. It may not have been an honest election, and I refuse to accept office under any cloud. Therefore, I resign in favor of," and I shall not mention his name even though he's now dead, "but the man who was taking this seriously and trying to help himself become a political boss through this gag election."
And when Alfred Knopf started the American Mercury, Mencken was a great magazine editor. Relations then between Angoff and Mencken were good.
The magazine was the darling of the college boys and college girls of America. It was also the darling of the newspaper reporters of the country. They all tried to get into its pages, and we used to get loads of mail from them. We appealed without question chiefly to the young intellectuals on the college campuses and in the newspaper offices. These youngsters were greatly disillusioned. It was right after World War I. A great many of them had some doubts about the war and about how much democracy it brought to the world. Money began to jingle in the pockets of their parents, their own pockets. People had lost their moorings, moral, spiritual, intellectual. The great intellectual leaders of the time didn't make much sense to them. All men like Irving Babbitt, Henry Van Dyke, Nicholas Murray Butler, and so forth. Our general age range, I imagine, was of interest, was between 18 and 25. We did not appeal, even in our glorious days, I believe, to the more mature people.
Two women of dubious reputation try to join the church. A plot like that was Mencken's meat, and therein rests the case of Hatrack.
He called the article Hatrack, and he printed it in the April 1926 issue of the American Mercury.
The author, Herbert Asbury.
And the article was a true story about a woman whose real name I knew, but who was known in our town as Hatrack, and she had a sister called Shoestring. But Hatrack was very anxious to belong to a church, but she didn't have any success. Then she'd go right back to her previous life. Well, Mencken liked the article, and when the magazine appeared on the newsstands, the Watch and Ward Society in Boston, which is headed by a minister named the Reverend J. Frank Chase, banned it from the Boston newsstands.
Mencken's reaction was to fight.
Publisher Knopf.
Almost immediately, we telephoned Arthur Garfield Hayes and went down together to Hayes' office and engaged him as counsel. And it was in that first meeting with Hayes that Mencken proposed himself that he go up to the Boston Common and personally sell a copy of the magazine and be arrested and tried immediately. And that was precisely what happened.
When I got to Boston, I went up to his room, and then I found him sitting in the bathtub smoking a cigar, but there wasn't any water in the bathtub. I gathered from that he was a little bit excited. And we all went down to the Boston Common, and there Mencken and Hayes met the Reverend Chase in the presence of about 20,000 people. Mencken handed Mr. Chase a copy of the magazine, and Mr. Chase handed Mencken $0.50, which Mencken bit and then put in his pocket. And then a police captain brushed through the crowd and arrested Mencken on a charge of selling obscene literature and was tried next morning in the magistrate's court. I testified that the article was true, and I was asked several questions. The prosecuting attorney wanted to know if I was a Christian, and I told him I was. And then Mencken testified that he was the editor of the Mercury and that he had printed the article because it was good literature and a good story. And he knew of no reason why he shouldn't have printed it. Mencken was not the Mencken that everybody thought he was. He was not the Mencken of the Vitriolic Trust. He treated the judge and the prosecuting attorneys exactly like they were the Supreme Court and the Attorney General of the United States. The judge said he had read the article overnight, that it was not obscene, that he found it well written, and that the fact that the Mercury was a 50-cent magazine would in itself keep the article away from youthful minds and others about whose morals the Reverend Chase was so worried. So Mencken was acquitted.
Not that the Mercury's problems were over.
Finally, these religious groups, mostly Methodists, got to the Post Office Department. The Post Office Department held a series of very peculiar hearings in which people testified that the Hatrack article was vicious and vile and immoral and obscene, although they admitted they hadn't read it. The Post Office Department issued an order barring that issue from the mails. There were 8-column headlines on newspapers in Boston and New York and Baltimore and all around about Mencken's trial and a terrific uproar. And various religious groups around the country began holding mass meetings, denouncing me and Mencken, demanding that Mencken and I be put in jail and the magazine be abolished. Meanwhile, Knopf had taken absolutely no advantage of the publicity. He could have sold hundreds of thousands of copies, but he never printed a single extra copy, so that the magazine was scarce. And news dealers all over the country got in the habit of chaining copies to a newsstand and charging 10 cents to read it. One news dealer in Oklahoma City wrote me that he made $70 out of one copy until it was read to pieces. He had it chained and he charged a man a dime to stand there and read it.
There's one aspect of the Mencken character unknown to many. Cigar-chewing, facetious Mencken, like all cynics, was a sentimentalist. He'll never surrender his bachelorhood, his friends and followers would say. Not after writing his sarcastic, ironically titled In Defense of Women. It would be out of character.
One would have thought that he would be the very last man to marry.
Magazine publisher Robin Harris.
He didn't shy away from women. He just was not the marrying type. This saying is attributed to him that romance is the star man looks up to, and marriage is the coal hole he falls into.
Before long, one thing led to another.
During his married life, which I think was the happiest period in his life,
John Owens, also former editor-in-chief, Sun Papers.
In an old house on Cathedral Street, overlooking Mount Vernon Square. Either a part of the house or the house next door had been taken by the Christian Scientists, and they had organized a Sunday school up there. So on Sunday mornings, Mencken would sit in his apartment and listen to the little children in the Christian Science Sunday School singing their Sunday morning songs. Here was the man jeering at organized religion. And somebody who ought to know better said, "Well, why do you listen to it?" "Oh," said Mencken, "I love to hear their little treble voices."
Yes, when his friends least expected it, Mencken turned soft, even when his favorite club, the Saturday Night Club, was in danger. Here, Mencken and a select group of friends gathered to play music each Saturday night.
One time, that privacy was invaded.
Teacher Louis Cheslock.
Some young intellectuals, maybe pacifists, maybe communists, we never found out who or what they actually were, decided to crash the Saturday Night Club. They were met at the door by Buchholz, and they promptly planted a good punch on Buchholz's nose for trying to deny them entrance, and that wound up in sort of a fiasco, the whole club and these two unpacific pacifists were hauled into the police station. Nobody wanted to press charges against them. We thought they were just two misguided young fellows. Henry, in particular, asked the judge to dismiss the case, which he did, and of course that was the end of that episode.
Mencken, the libertarian, the voice of freedom, lived by a rigid schedule. James Kane, the author.
There's another Mencken, who was not at all irrational. The fellow that got up at 7 o'clock in the morning, had breakfast, went to work at 10 o'clock after reading the New York Times, worked till 12:30, had lunch, lay down, had his nap, went back to work at 3 o'clock, worked until 6, signed off for the day, had a cocktail, had dinner, read all night until 12 o'clock, went to sleep. He worked like a clock. He worked like a metronome. He was absolutely reliable. He paid his debts. He died worth $400,000. There was nothing irrational about that guy.
There are those who say Mencken never possessed a conscience.
One curious aspect of Mencken's writing habits was his need to wash his hands frequently.
William Manchester.
This seems odd and is only worth mentioning because it seemed compulsive. During an evening's writing, he would rise several times and make his way to the bathroom to thoroughly scrub his hands. And this became so important to him that very early in his career, he had a washstand installed in his study.
Sentimentalist, traditionalist, self-disciplinarian. They spelled out one of the darkest periods of Mencken's life. He was German. Mencken and his assistant Angoff had already argued about the Depression.
Then, of course, there's the Hitler business. He thought Hitler wouldn't last very long. He was sure the German people wouldn't stand for a clown like that. The German people did stand for him. But what riled me up particularly was that he was so calm about Hitler and didn't denounce his restriction of civil liberties. Mencken was always a great defender of civil liberties and fought bravely for them. But apparently, as I told him to his face, his interest in civil liberties stopped at the Rhine.
During his lifetime, the United States warred against Germany twice. Twice, Mencken was in trouble. Veteran newsman Herbert Bayard Swope.
Many people call him a radical. Menck was probably the most conservative mind I have ever known. Whatever was new was to be distrusted and avoided. Whatever was old was good and solid because it had survived. He spewed upon idealism. In 1915, Mencken was an ardent supporter of the Kaiser. He pooh-poohed the tendency it was bringing us into the war and was bitterly opposed to Wilson because he was convinced that Wilson was making war inevitable. Then again, when the New York World made a countrywide exposure of KKK, which shook certain sections of the South to its foundation. He pooh-poohed that. And the climax came in our last war, when Menck, to all intents and purposes, was a Nazi. In fact, he never took the trouble to deny it.
Biographer Manchester thinks he understands Mencken's attitude.
Mencken was often, in the late 1930s, accused of being pro-Hitler. And I think that's a ghost which ought to be laid. It is certainly true that Mencken was pro-German. Why not? He was of German ancestry. He grew up in a German-American neighborhood at a time when Germans stuck together in Baltimore, lived in the same part of the city. Most of his friends were of German parentage. He was himself third generation. But his Germany was, I think, 19th century Germany, or certainly Germany before their Kaiser. It was the Germany of Beethoven, of Goethe, certainly of Nietzsche. He was in Germany before World War I. He never forgot it. He certainly sentimentalized it. But it was a quaint 19th century picturesque Bavaria that Mencken carried around in his mind, and certainly not the Germany of stormtroopers. In World War I, he was castigated. He was certainly partial to the Germans from 1914 on. There's no doubt of that. But in the early 1930s, when Hitler came to power, and Germans in this country were being asked to join such organizations as the Bunds and the Friends of Germany, Mencken wrote a letter, which I have reprinted. Mencken wouldn't reprint it himself. I think that's significant. This was a private matter to him, in which he said that Adolf Hitler imitated the monkey shines of the American Legion at its worst, that Hitler hurt Germany,
that this was the very sort of thing which made Germany appear foolish in the eyes of the world, that Hitler was a clown and worse, a scoundrel, that he wanted nothing to do with him. At no point was Mencken ever a supporter of Hitler's, quite the contrary. However, when those attacking Hitler undertook to attack Germany, Mencken sprang to Germany's defense.
Still, big man that he was, Mencken couldn't stand up against the tide of public opinion.
The saddest and the least effective part of Mencken's career was during the two wars. He made a fetish, you see, of his German blood. He was over there in the First World War as a war correspondent, as you know. In fact, he was the last one to leave the German lines. The Kaiser, by the way, was an admirer of Mencken. And I think that pleased him, because that also irritated Democrats, you see, I mean, with a small d. He never faced the reality of the 20th century, in fact. He only grudgingly admitted that this was the only country where he would have been allowed to condemn democracy so much and enjoy the fruits of its freedom. He wasn't blind about Hitler. He thought Hitler was a new broom who'd do Germany a lot of good, and he was a clown, and then he began to think he was a maniac. But he was never publicly shocked. I'm sure he was deeply, personally embittered by his treatment of the Jews. But you see, somehow that was not in his province, he felt. It had a touch of confusion, his attitude. I mean, rather like the Hollywood actor who says, well, of course, you know, the atom bomb's got nothing to do with me. I'm just an actor. And that's where Mencken fell down, I think.
Fell down he did. Times changed. Mencken didn't.
Well, in the lush days of the so-called Coolidge prosperity, when Jimmy Walker, being late at City Hall every morning and not keeping his engagement, was a great joke, Mencken's impish humor and his mischievous tendencies all fitted into the spirit of the times. It was a part of the humor of the time. Well, when you look around and 100,000 people in your town who are losing their homes, you slow down. You don't want that humor. And Mencken himself was quite incapable in many ways of having that sort of humor at that sort of a time. You sit in the office and in would come a bulletin, and here in Baltimore, 7,000 people would be let out of one factory one afternoon. You'd do what Mencken would do and everybody else. You'd sit there a little while and say, how are those people going to eat? That was going all over the country. The robust, gusty, lusty humor of Mencken didn't fit the time.
Through the years, Mencken's following sank, and so did his health. The climax came in 1948 with a cerebral hemorrhage. H.L. Mencken, who ripped into everybody, was a target himself.
He said to me, when I get to heaven, I'm going to speak to God very sharply. He said, he has treated me shabbily.
Because of the stroke, he could neither read nor write. He could go to the movies, which he hated. The savage irony ran rampant. Mencken was a very fast reader. No one could read fast enough to him. Instead, he sawed wood, puttered in his garden, until his secretary, Mrs. Rosalind Lorfink, accidentally came across a manuscript. While Mencken lay vegetating, the manuscript, cast aside before the stroke 8 years earlier, lay gathering dust. It was quite a day when Mrs. Lorfink found it.
We were getting the things ready to send to the Pratt Library. We had so many envelopes and so many card files and that we just simply discovered it. We fell on it, in other words, or would have gone to the Pratt Library and probably stayed there for 20 or 25 years. But when I came back, I brought it up to the office and showed it to Mr. Mencken, and most of all, I can recall that he was so delighted when I discovered that he had already not only collected the aphorisms that were included, but what delighted him most of all was that he had already written the preface, because he realized he couldn't write it at that time. And he was very, very delighted that he was coming at it. Of course, you probably have read in the paper that he was delighted that it was going to be denounced again, because it is Mencken's style, and he will be denounced.
Minority Report, which kept Mencken alive just a little longer, was published this past spring. Sure, Mencken will be denounced, but how else would he want it? On paper, he had the last word, and well, somehow through these only recordings of his voice, Mencken also got the last spoken word.
I was born an agnostic. My father was one ahead of me, and his father ahead of him.
So agnosticism is nothing new to me. I'll point out one of the strange corollaries, and that is this. A man who is an agnostic by inheritance, so that he doesn't remember any time that he wasn't, has almost no hatred for the religious. I get on very well with all kinds of ecclesiastics and all kinds of pious people, because I don't have any evil conscience in the matter. I'm not a renegade, no feeling of sin, whatever. I assume that they've got a right to believe anything they please. Being an extreme libertarian and believing in free speech and every other kind of freedom up to the last limits of the endurable. I think there is a limit beyond which free speech can't go, but it's a limit that's very seldom mentioned. It's the point where free speech begins to collide with the right to privacy. I don't think there are any other conditions to free speech. I've got a right to say and believe anything I please, but I haven't got a right to press it on anybody else. For example, take, for instance, the Catholic Church, which I am on good terms with personally, but have no belief in whatsoever. I've got a right to print my dissent from its doctrines. I have exercised that right for many years. But I have no right to go on the cathedral steps on Sunday morning when the Catholics are coming out of High Mass and make a speech denouncing them. I don't think there is any such right. Nobody's got a right to be a nuisance to his neighbors.
H. L. Mencken, The Bitter Byline, written and edited by William Hill and Jerome Jacobs, was produced for the NBC Radio Network by NBC News. Your narrator was Chet Huntley.
Biographies and Sound on Tuned to Yesterday, an NBC episode from July 10, 1956. And so closes this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.